KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Judy, I can't understand your buying a piece of mining property from that handsome salesman without seeing it.
I didn't have to see it, Aunt Aggie. I saw the salesman.
Human culture has grown up with these microflora, whether it's in cheese or wine or mead.
This bill takes away that right and says that if someone thinks you're dangerous, we'll hold you without a trial. It's an abomination. It should not stand.
Senator Rand Paul talking about the National Defense Authorization Act, an amendment there. Also, Sarah Dickerman on some eating and a clip from an old-time radio show. All things we're going to talk about this hour on the program, including we're going to get some of your regrets for 2012. But we start with the National Defense Authorization Act. It had a provision in it that would forbid the military from detaining American citizens and permanent residents indefinitely and without a trial. Last week, lawmakers removed that provision. Out of the four main negotiators on the defense bill, only Representative Adam Smith, a Democrat of Washington, opposed the change to the bill. We'll ask him why. Adam Smith, thanks for talking to us.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very good. And by the way, I understand, according to Harry Reid, that you're sitting around watching movies this week.
Yeah, no, not actually. But I wasn't aware that Harry Reid was watching us all that closely.
He's watching you closely. He's like Santa Claus.
Yeah, I guess so. First of all, in your intro there, there's a couple things that are wrong, and I didn't understand what you meant about what I opposed or didn't oppose. But the provision that was in the bill that Senator Feinstein got put in did not eliminate indefinite detention. It had language in it that said, you know, you shall not do indefinite detention, you know, and listed the rights and all that. But then at the end of it, it said, unless, you know, specifically authorized by Congress. And, you know, Lindsey Graham, who is as strong a supporter of indefinite detention as you will find, voted for the Feinstein Amendment because he felt that it did not change the law, that basically the action of the 2001 authorization for the use of military force, as the courts have interpreted, did authorize detention. So now I supported the Feinstein language. I was happy to keep it in there. Unfortunately, others did not. But it really wouldn't have made any difference in terms of current law, and that's what a big misunderstanding is out there. I had an amendment on the House side that unequivocally said no indefinite detention in the U.S. of anybody, not limiting it just to U.S. citizens or lawful resident aliens. It was, you know, it was defeated on the floor, and that's still what we need to do to make certain that there can be no indefinite detention. But the Feinstein language, and then actually there is language in the Defense Authorizing Act that says essentially what the Feinstein language said, that was put in by the House Republicans, which said, you know, you have to give everyone habeas, you have to give everyone their Article III court constitutional rights, unless there's a law that says otherwise, which is basically what the Feinstein language said. And then you get into an argument about whether or not there is a law that says otherwise. And most would argue that the 2001 authorization for the use of military force is such a law.
And how long does that law stay in effect until it's repealed?
Yeah, it's not. There's no sunset on it. Look, I mean, the problem is, and when we were moving this bill through the House, I tried to have a straightforward, unequivocal, we're not going to do indefinite detention amendment. And I had that amendment. And then what happened was you had a lot of people, you know, particularly within the Republican Party, who basically wanted to have their cake and eat it too. They wanted to be able to say to their civil libertarians, look, hey, we put this provision in here that's going to stop military custody and indefinite detention. But then they wanted to say to their sort of national security zealots on the other side, but also we made sure we protected what was in the AUMF. I mean, the one cancels out the other, and, you know, we got into all kinds of legalistic back and forth on the language. But at the end of the day, you know, you had one part of it doing one thing and the other part of it eliminating what that first part did. And that's, in essence, what the Feinstein language did. Now, I know it's been misinterpreted. People have said that it would have banned indefinite detention, but I didn't find one single solitary attorney who agreed with that interpretation.
So what do I make from Rand Paul's statement there? Is he one of the people you're saying is trying to have his cake and eat it too?
No. Rand Paul is one of those people who genuinely does want to get rid of indefinite detention. He is under the mistaken belief Feinstein Amendment did that. Like I said, I was happy keeping the Feinstein language in there. It's relatively harmless, and who knows, maybe some court would have misinterpreted it and made it more difficult to do indefinite detention. But Rand Paul believed that. But again, I mean, John McCain, you know, Lindsey Graham, you know, a whole lot of the Republicans who, you know, were, you know, steadfastly against my amendment supported the Feinstein Amendment because they didn't think it made any difference. Now, look, I mean, the truth is we haven't indefinitely detained anyone in the U.S. In quite some time. I think, you know, the Bush administration did it on three occasions that were all very confused, and then eventually put that person into trial or released them. But I just don't think it should be on the books. I think we should make it very clear that indefinite detention is not a tool that is any longer going to be used in dealing with the you know, Al-Qaeda, the war against Al-Qaeda. But again, the amendments that were put in there, you know, were just confusing language that didn't, in a straightforward way, eliminate it as I would like.
Is that why it was stripped out of the bill in the end? Or?
Well, no. In the end, I think it was stripped out of the bill. The Senate, you know, the Senate brokered that compromise, basically trying to please both sides. And then, as the thing moved through, you know, senators on both sides of the debate sort of realized that it didn't really do what they wanted to do. So there simply wasn't much support from the Senate. And then, of course, the House majority was completely opposed to it, which is interesting because as I read the language that we eventually put into the bill, which was based on an amendment by Louie Gohmert on the House side, Louie Gohmert had an amendment that basically said, you know, if you have habeas rights, you know, nothing in the 2012 NDAA or the 2001 AUMF should take them away. And, you know, so we kept some of that language in there, but then they put the backside of it in there, which said, you know, unless there's a prior law by Congress that authorizes it. So in essence, the language, you know, based on the Gohmert Amendment in the House is essentially the same as what the Feinstein language was, which is on the one hand, you know, make sure you protect everybody's rights. You know, everyone gets habeas, everyone gets Article III courts and constitutional due process, unless there's a law that says otherwise.
So Adam Smith, here's one of the things that I read that I wanted to ask you about that was
sure.
That was raising the question, which was that civil liberty groups weren't necessarily upset about the demise of this Feinstein-Lee Amendment, because it protected only U.S. citizens and permanent residents rather than all persons present in the United States.
Yep.
Is that accurate?
That
would and would your amendment have protected all persons present in the United States?
Yes. In fact, that's one of the things that is interesting. The Gohmert language that we put in, you know, originally his only protected citizens and lawful resident aliens, but I insisted that language come out because arguably when Gohmert said, you know, if you're a citizen or a lawful resident alien, you get habeas, you know, he was actually reducing rights because right now the Constitution says no matter who you are, you get habeas. And that was something that was upheld in the Hamdi decision when the Bush administration had tried to use Guantanamo, you know, to say, well, that's not in the U.S., so you don't get habeas, but the courts disagreed. So it would have restricted it so that, you know, undocumented people in the U.S. would not have gotten the rights that they've always gotten. And we did change that. And actually the Gohmert language now is every person, you know, not just citizens or lawful resident aliens, and that's in the bill. Every person gets these rights, unless, of course, you know, there is a law previously stating that they don't.
So where are we in terms of this larger question? Because there are critics who are saying this is, you know, this is the slow death of the Fifth Amendment.
Yeah, well, we are where we've been, frankly, since 2001, which is that, you know, I believe the executive branch has way too much power to indefinitely detain people. Now, we've been focused on within the U.S., but this, you know, applies outside of the U.S. Now, again, this is a power that the Obama administration has never used, and the Bush administration only briefly used on three occasions. They're very convoluted. Don't want to take the time to walk through them now. So it's not something that's been used that often, but still, to have the executive branch with that power is dangerous. And then the larger issue, the bigger, more important issue to my mind, is the, and I forget the number off the top of my head now, it's somewhere around 170 people who are still locked down in Guantanamo Bay, many of whom, you know, have no rights. They are indefinitely detained at Guantanamo Bay, no prospect of a trial, no prospect of having an appeal. They are simply being warehoused down there with no due process rights. And once again, and not just in the defense bill, but in the continuing resolution that we passed to keep the government funded, the Republicans insisted on language that bars the president from transferring anybody out of Guantanamo to the U.S. and places enormous restrictions on their ability to return any of those people to their home country. So that continues to be just, you know, a complete civil rights disaster that I think we need to address.
Does that extend to those prisons outside Guantanamo where allegedly people are being held under either American authority directly or with American acceptance without trial?
Well, I don't think at this point there's any allegedly about that. We are not holding people or, you know, exercising that type of power anywhere other than Guantanamo Bay and Afghanistan. Afghanistan is the other place, and that is, you know, the law of war, rather, arguably applies in Afghanistan, and we are holding many people there as, you know, prisoners of war as opposed to, you know, criminals, and that raises a whole series of different issues, particularly as we prepare to draw down in Afghanistan. But those are the two places where people are being held outside the normal constitutional due process of a federal court.
So what do you do next, Adam Smith? Reintroduce this amendment again?
Absolutely. And, you know, I'm going to keep pushing on two fronts. One is to stop indefinite detention as a tool in the fight against Al-Qaeda. I simply do not believe it's necessary. Our Article III courts have proven more than up to the task. We've had, I think, well over 400 convictions now of people accused of terrorism that have gone through the normal constitutional due process. It has worked quite well. And it maintains our international credibility, so I want to get rid of indefinite detention that way. And then I continue to say that we ought to close Guantanamo Bay, and, you know, whether it's through military commissions or preferably through Article III courts, you know, try or release everybody who is there, except for, you know, there's a few folks, clearly Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, but they're going through military commissions. You know, and close down Guantanamo Bay, and that's the fight we have to keep having. Regrettably, you know, about a year, 2 years ago now, the Republicans got the upper hand, you know, somehow arguing that despite the fact that we've already, you know, tried and convicted over 400 terrorists in the United States through Article III courts, is now suddenly incapable of using that process. But I think we need to keep pushing on that argument because, look, our, you know, our values, our Constitution are incredibly important in and of themselves, and they're also important in terms of our credibility. We have difficulty, you know, working with partner nations, getting them to turn, you know, terrorist suspects over to us now because those countries don't feel that our, you know, the process that we're giving those inmates is legitimate. And that is undermining our ability to properly protect ourselves in addition to violating what I think are our core constitutional principles. So we keep fighting. We keep pushing the argument. It's unfortunate that the smokescreen has been able to be thrown up with the, you know, well, we had an amendment that would have done it. Well, we didn't because right next to it was the language that said unless another law says otherwise. So I got to sort of break through that smokescreen and continue to stay focused on the very clear issue of eliminating the right of indefinite detention.
If we put prisoners through that trial and they were distributed to prisons in the U.S., would you have any qualms about taking a duly tried prisoner into a federal prison in Washington State?
Absolutely not. I mean, look, we have federal prisons in Washington State. I have a federal detention facility right down in the southern part of my district in SeaTac.
Right.
You know, we have got murderers and rapists and pedophiles and, yes, terrorists incarcerated all across this country. And I haven't heard any problem with our maximum security prisons. Let me tell you something. If there is a problem, if we can't hold these dangerous people in the U.S. Safely, then we got a problem right now that we better fix. I don't think we do. So it's got nothing to do with bringing more people in here. We already have some of the most dangerous people in the world being held in our prison system. We need a good, safe, secure prison system for precisely that reason, but we have it. So, no, I wouldn't have any problem whatsoever.
All right, Adam Smith, just before I let you go, fiscal slope, step, cliff, what's going to happen here in the next 5 days?
Look, I mean, the Republicans are insisting on the permanent extension of every single tax cut from the Bush era, before they will allow us to not, you know, go over the fiscal cliff on cutting spending. And that's, completely unacceptable. And I know people are frustrated. I'm frustrated. But look, if we want to avoid the fiscal cliff, all we'd have to do is give in to that and say, yep, let's just keep the deficit going through the ceiling by permanently extending every single tax cut in the last 10 years and set ourselves up for devastating cuts and mandatory and discretionary spending across the board. If we were willing to agree to that, we wouldn't have a problem. But we're not, because it's horrific policy. So we got to keep pushing and saying, look, yes, we need to have a sensible approach to our deficit, but revenue has to be part of that solution. Otherwise, you are looking at cuts in every program, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, defense, on down the line, of truly devastating levels. So, we just got to keep having that argument and try to make progress.
By the way, what's your opinion on where Medicare is on this discussion, or even Social Security, which I know has been sort of removed from it? But
I think Social Security is separate. I think there's ways to keep Social Security solvent that don't require you to make cuts in it. But I will say this, and I know people don't like to refer to it as entitlements, but mandatory spending, whatever you want to call it, the 60% of our budget that is made up of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, unemployment insurance, and then health care and retirement for retired federal employees, including military, that's 60% of a budget that's 40% out of whack. We got to find ways to save money in there. I don't disagree with that at all. And I'm wide open to ideas for how we do that. We have to spend less money in the next couple decades on entitlements than current law contemplates. There's no way to make the budget work otherwise. But I will again steadfastly say that part of that has to be also getting more revenue, because we have also had huge tax cuts in the last 10 or 12 years, lowest tax rates we've had since before World War II. I mean, the Clinton-era tax rates worked very well for just about everybody. Now, I don't want to see them all come back, but we have got to bring in more revenue, or the cuts on the spending side would be just devastating. But yes, it's to be cliche, you have to have a balanced approach between reductions in spending and tax increases.
All right.
That's what we've been arguing for quite a while.
All right, Congressman, I hope we'll have a more balanced and detailed discussion on that in the days ahead. Enjoy those movies, and thank you for talking to us about the National Defense Authorization Act and your amendment. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
Thank you. Adam Smith is a representative of the 9th District in Washington State. This is Weekday. Your regrets coming up.
We have clouds and rain, 45 degrees in the University District. Forecast calls for rain this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, the high in the mid-40s. Cloudy tonight with a chance of rain, the low near 37. Same for tomorrow. Clouds, chance of showers, the high in the low 40s.
Now is a great time of year to donate your used car, truck, boat, or other vehicle to KUOW. It's easy. Just call 1-866-KUOW-CAR before December 31st to make a tax-deductible donation of your used vehicle, or get started online at KUOW.org.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 10:23.
Regrets. I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I did what I had to do and saw it through without exemption.
Yeah, even old Blue Eyes has his regrets. So we're pausing for a few minutes this hour in these last days of 2012 to look back on the things we wished we'd done or not done, things we'd seen and wish we'd not seen, opportunities lost, words spoken or not spoken. So tell us those moments that remain stuck in your head. 206-543-5869, the things you most regret so you can get it off your chest, and then you'll be ready for your resolutions for the new year. 1-800-289-5869, 206-543-5869. We'll look ahead to 2013 by just going through a few regrets. The Strangers, David Schmader, is here with us. He thinks about regrets this time of year for his paper's annual regrets issue. It's a list of mistakes, missed opportunities, and blunders they say they made over the year. My regret is that this is not our idea, but that we're stealing it from you, from The Stranger.
That's a perfectly lovely regret. Hi.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
David Schmader is an associate editor at The Stranger. He's author of several solo plays, including his latest, A Short-Term Solution to a Long-Term Problem. He's been a guest on our show this year, of which I have no regrets.
Aw.
And I'm glad you have been. And for our culture panel, I'm still trying to look for a better name than that.
I know. I got to meet Chocolate.
Yeah, that was good. See, no regrets there.
No regrets.
One that you said you were getting some not-for-radio regrets with Jason off your chest so we wouldn't, you know, have any FCC violations. But there was one which I...
And it wasn't that bad for radio. I just wanted to keep us out of the bathroom. But the conflation of bears and toilet paper in TV commercials has ruined my life.
One of the worst things I've seen, I would say.
That's, you know,
it
I don't
just burns my eyeballs.
But yeah, it's just a bad thing.
The little white flecks of paper.
Don't it's get cute wrong. Around that.
Yeah.
it's like just, Honey Bucket. Don't get cute.
It's just so bad. It's just so bad. All right. Do you have any, before I turn to some phone calls, do you have any regrets?
The Stranger does this regrets this year every year where we come to the end of the year and we devote an entire issue to just regrets, regrets, regrets. We solicit regrets from artists, filmmakers, musicians, playwrights, dancers, and then we pack the feature well with our own regrets. And this is why I was interested in coming on here was it's a great way. This is kind of the first step to making your resolutions. You have to like sum up what you did wrong or what you regret doing, not doing, and then you will have a clear view to make a New Year's resolution. And that's what I say to myself to keep myself from thinking like, we're just swimming in regret for fun? No, this is a step to someplace better.
It's a step to healing.
Yes.
And moving forward.
And so we run, actual corrections, like misspelling someone's name or calling a cashew a nut instead of a seed.
Robert Ebert.
I'll just read that one. In the February 18 issue of The Stranger, we published film critic Roger Ebert's name as Robert Ebert. Good Lord, that's embarrassing. We regret the error. So there's tons of real regrets. And then we kind of branch out into aesthetic regrets, like suggesting shows that ended up being terrible, or morality-based regrets, like, okay, here's one. Stranger writer Brendan Kiley regrets that we live in a world where people announce deaths via Facebook and that so many people respond by clicking like.
Yeah, I know.
It's a conundrum because like doesn't mean condolences, but that's what it feels like when you click it. But then you're clicking, I'm glad your dad died.
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. I liked this one from Charles Mudede. Charles Mudede regrets that death really is the end of life. There's no afterlife. There's nothing but nothing in death. Worst of all, to die is to never have lived at all. When you die, the nothingness before life meets the nothingness after life. This meeting erases every memory, every trace of light from your life. Only the living know the dead.
Happy Thursday.
Yes. I would say I regret even reading that.
Oh, no. Don't you feel lighter just knowing that someone else walks around with those thoughts and you get to be not that person?
Well, that's why we read Charles Mudede, right? Because he is thinking about those things in a way that none of us really are.
Yeah.
We got some regrets from Oprah and other celebrities.
I didn't know she ever deigned to regret a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. She had some regrets. Apparently, she regrets not knowing that it would have been hard to start a new TV network, and maybe that she got lost at all.
Wow, I don't know. She's she built the other one slowly, and jumping into the TV network, I don't have any sympathy for her, but good for her for admitting it.
I guess.
You remember the Seattle diver who punched an octopus to death?
Yes. Okay. He regrets.
He regrets it. And I feel like it is our duty as humans to give him props for coming back after being such a jerk about punching the octopus to death. And he has since apologized and went to that meeting and was like, I will not punch octopuses anymore. And so good for you. I have his actual name, Dylan Mayer. You have taught us all something about, regret and moving forward.
And perhaps we all should regret that we don't post that this is not a real marine sanctuary, but we think of it as a marine sanctuary. So be that as it may, perhaps we should make it a marine sanctuary.
That would be nice.
Yes. Oprah said, had I known it was this difficult, I might have done something else. for the Oprah Winfrey.
Quilting?
Like, yeah. Would she just... And Mitt Romney's campaign manager said he regretted immigration stance.
Mitt Romney also has gotten around to this, I didn't really want to be president. Like his regret, his son has been in the main.
I haven't heard that.
This. It's the son flag or tip has said that.
Tag. His, slip.
said, his dad didn't really want it. He did spend $45 million of his own money. So
didn't
I
didn't really want
what
it?
He would. It's the whole thing has been sour grapes from them the whole time.
So perhaps the Republicans again will regret having chosen Mitt Romney as their
who
as
else
their
were they
going to
pick?
Here.
Remember who the other ones were?
I think Herman Cain would have made a wonderful
for people like us. Herman Cain would have been a delightful few months of American life. But
did you watch the Daily Show with Herman Cain this year, where John Oliver had him read various greetings to aliens if they had invaded from outer space as president? He did a very good job.
They should probably hire him full time.
All right, what are your regrets for this year? 206-543-5869. I have a few more to read. 1-800-289-5869. President Obama says he regrets the syntax of "you didn't build that remark." Obviously, I have regrets for my syntax, he said. I could spend the entire hour regretting my syntax.
You should work on that for next year. That'd be awesome to swim through an entire year of live radio.
Oh, man. Just if we played all the times I mangled the language. I regret that you have to hear that. Ketlea, is that how you say your name in South Lake Union?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. What do you regret?
Well,
I see what you don't regret, but I want to know what you do regret first.
You want to know what I do regret? Well, I do regret... See, I don't. I just keep coming back to these things that I'm like, I regret moving off of Capitol Hill, but I'm like, no, I don't actually. I lived there for all of my 20s. I love the Hill, but what do I regret? I don't know. This was a very good year. The last couple of years were pretty bad, so I think I'm just trying to focus on the positive.
Now, my message here says you don't regret leaving Seattle, but... Aren't you still in Seattle?
I am still in Seattle, and
that's why she doesn't regret leaving.
Last fall, I don't regret staying in Seattle.
Ah, well, that's fine. By the way, you live in South Lake Union?
I live in South Lake Union. Yeah.
How do you feel about that neighborhood? Any regrets there for the people who have built it?
I do regret that I have been eating out so much this year, because this is like a cascade of Tom Douglas restaurants here. So like every corner, and like they're diverse and, you know, lots of different types of food, but it's all kind of that kind of food that's not like great for your waist, I guess.
many people are going to agree with you at this time of year for that. I appreciate you calling. It's very the only regret she could get was that she'd been eating a little too much Tom Douglas food.
And you had to bully her into it.
I know. I think for many of us, perhaps it will be just a year of very few regrets.
I guess. Can that be? I mean, there's all the obvious ones. Like, we can regret triggers and bullets and...
19 months of a campaign.
19 months of a campaign. Amazing, amazing evidence of global warming, I would say.
Yes.
Water in the subway. Yes. That's crazy.
But at least less denial this time around than in times past.
Yes.
And that's been interesting.
And I'm glad that Ketlea has, you know, she kind of is, her regret could be, well, just that she had these crappy years leading up to this year. Like, good for her for not having anything to regret finally.
Yeah, it's nice. That's nice. Dennis is in Seattle. Dennis, for you, what is the regret?
Well, my regret is playing too many video games.
Was there any tangible fallout, or is it just a personal feeling inside?
Well, you know, no tangible fallout. I'm still a contributing member to society. but, you know, it's just I look back on my early years and how many hours I spent playing video games, and I could probably speak Mandarin, French, Spanish, and maybe one more language if I spend all that time on a language.
All right, what games? Give me a couple of games that you've been playing this year.
Oh, I played about 4 hours of StarCraft II last night, which is great. I mean, I play with my friends, so it's a bonding experience.
There you go.
FIFA soccer, and of course the dreaded Call of Duty.
Yeah, yeah. Well, see, you're going to be with a lot, what, a couple of million people there on Call of Duty around the world.
Yes,
at least.
It's what boggles my mind is that every hour of the day, there's probably about 10,000 people playing.
Why don't you and your friends join the army?
No, I think. What about doing that? Aren't there some video games or video collaborations where you're solving chemical problems or health problems?
Those are good problems, but I think that we should spend more time on those in the tangible world and not in the video game world.
Fair enough.
Not any games that you can. Solve world hunger or, cure cancer.
So tell me something. Yes, you regret spending that much time playing those video games. But next year rolling around next week, you're still going to have the same stresses. You think you're going to say, I'm going to spend less time playing those video games?
Well, I'm going to have new stresses. I'm starting graduate school at the University of Washington. So I think that video games will stop being a pastime for me and start being kind of like a stress release. It'll be like a 20 minutes in the evening to kind of unwind a little bit and, kill some zombies or, destroy some alien civilization.
Hey, Dennis, thanks for that. I appreciate your call. We're getting your regrets. I like that notion of, when you're going to graduate school, you need that.
It's, it's probably better than a million other things, gambleholics or anything.
Say, you write often. Do you have any particular regrets about your approach this year? And as you know, I'm always learning. I'm trying to learn.
There was the closest thing I can think of is I brought a whole bunch of pessimism to the election and marriage equality just because of kind of growing up gay in Texas and the kind of PTSD that would give you about what humans – think of homosexuals. So I was not banking on majority approval of same-sex marriage rights. And I feel like I held back my excitement because I didn't want to have to mourn it if it failed. So I was just like, this is a popularity contest. I'm not going to treat it like it's evidence of humanity's growth or failure. But then when it passed, of course, I was thrilled that humanity had grown. So I held back en route to that because I was very emotionally knotted up about it, and it felt like something that was out of my hands. And then I ignored some arts I didn't get to see.
That happens.
Yeah.
You went to others.
I did go to others.
That issue of same-sex marriage equality, going down there and hanging out with people as they were lined up to get their licenses was one of the really great times of my working life.
Yay.
My only regret would be if I hadn't done that, because that was wonderful. And not always understanding how important it was, but really having those conversations with folks.
Yeah, this town brought it. That was great. The straight people in this town who just showed up and were like, we're so happy that we made this happen was unbelievable. Yeah, I'll never forget it.
It's very interesting. I did ask a lot of young couples if they thought, okay, now that you can get married, I mean, marriage is a big deal. Are you sure you want to go through with this? And they all said, yeah, we're ready.
Yep. And yeah, we'll see. Yeah. Amazing. What about you?
I'm still thinking. I know I have so many that they tumble forth. I'm thinking. I'm still with syntax. Mike is in Redmond. Mike, what about you? What are your regrets this year?
Well, I moved here from Michigan in 2010, and from that point on, I would periodically hear about the MOHI, Museum of History and Industry, and I've even took a hike around the grounds. And I never visited it at its original location. I regret not going to its old location. Now I see they moved, and I no longer have that chance. So I'll make sure I'm going to get to their new location, but I regret not going to the original museum.
Well, you can walk around the outside. Is the big cannon or the artillery gun still there, I think, at the old place? I don't know if it is or not. But you'll get a whole new experience with the new place, fresh, because you haven't been to the old place. You'll like it, I think, Mike.
I hope so.
Thanks. We're gathering regrets. Not many people have regrets this time of year. Most people are. I think it's hard.
You guys aren't digging deep enough.
I think it's hard. Like, I was thinking, you asked me, what about me? Well, I didn't get out enough for work or for play, but that's kind of simple. And I didn't take care of myself as well as I should have. And therefore, I saw mortality stare me in the face. And I regret seeing that.
It's true. There is this divide between like light, fluffy regrets and then deep personal regrets that'll probably like when I found the same thing, I was like, oh, what do I actually regret? And it's stuff like I said to my mom 12 years ago that I've apologized for 100 times. Like there'll just be like the perma regrets that you wake up thinking about.
Some things hold you tight, don't they? I mean, some things are maybe permanent regrets for a reason, sort of a reminder of how one should act.
Yes, as long as they're not crippling, I'll let them hang around. But yeah, you don't want to be frozen, but you want to be wiser.
Yeah, yeah.
What did
well,
death look
see,
like?
On that, not what
you. Nothing you want to see.
Nothing you want to see.
All right.
I lost some people close to me, and so you know, you look at that and you go, "Whoa."
It was a bad year for particularly Seattle theater. We lost a couple major.
Yeah.
Forces to the cancer that will ruin so many of our lives.
Yeah. All right. What are you going to do for a resolution then?
My resolution. Okay. I always have this habit of making.
See, there I am. I'm already moving on past.
Yeah. You just get out. Yeah. It's easy to like make resolutions, envision it like a superhero movie where you wake up and you kick your old life in the face, and that always fails. So I'm trying to envision my resolution as more like a Robert Altman movie where you just like walk around and say things and try to do better. Like, it's not a revolution. It's just a little tweaking and finessing. So I think that'll be the best way to actually make resolutions stick instead of the superhero revolution method.
Yeah, that's good. I agree with you.
So you just, you know, exercising more, returning phone calls promptly.
Ooh, all the good stuff.
Yeah, just the basic human care things that I can – when you get freaky busy, you're like – you feel – like you deserve to kind of cast those by the side.
You know, speaking of the superhero part, Katie Sewell was assigned the task of tap dancing before the year ended, and she did it. She went and tap danced and met that resolution.
So but
you are a superhero.
But I regret that I didn't start doing it earlier in the year. Because as it stands, I only took one lesson. And so my goal was to actually be able to tap my way out of the studio by the end of the year. And that is not going to be happening.
Time step.
Yeah. And yeah. You still got some time. All right.
A couple more days.
All right. Some thoughts on regrets with David Schmader, associate editor of The Stranger, author of several solo plays, including his latest, A Short-Term Solution to a Long-Term Problem. I look forward to speaking with you more in the new year, where we will talk about issues of portent to the culture and
bears and toilet paper.
Yes, that is going to be burned inevitably into our consciousness. We must rid ourselves of that. Happy New Year, sir.
Happy New Year.
This is Weekday.
You're walking down the street and someone asks you for money. What do you do? Giving money to the homeless is the conversation at noon today, and we welcome your thoughts right now at our listener feedback line, 206-221-3663. Do you give money to panhandlers? Tell us why or why not. 206-221-3663.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, TV. The business is still kicking. The question is, why?
If your cable goes out for a day, you're furious, right? If your newspaper didn't come for a day, or if you couldn't get a CD for a day, you'd find a way to move on. But if you can't watch TV, you freak out.
A special hour devoted to the present and future of television on the next On the Media.
And that comes your way Sunday night at 6 o'clock. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. It's 10:44. We have clouds and rain, 45 degrees in the U District. Forecast calls for rain this morning, tapering off to just a chance of rain later today, the high in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy tonight and tomorrow with a chance of showers. Tonight's low 37, tomorrow's high reaching 43.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is Jack Benny talking. Jordan, Rocky Jordan.
Have you ever danced with a murderer?
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
King County.
As the music plays, the magic of radio brings you another edition of Radio Retrospective. Katie Sewell's exploration of the old-time radio saga, along with me, Steve Sher. You know, Katie, let me check what our sponsors have to think about that.
Yeah, let's check about the sponsors. I thought, you know, a couple weeks ago we were talking about radio advertising, and I thought, let's look at it a little bit more today. Nowadays, you know, television networks have people that are selling ad time to advertisers, and the networks are laying out the schedule of when the commercials are going to run based on the time slot, what show it is, what the advertisers pay. That's the system now. But that was not so during the era of radio drama. Sponsors, not the networks at that time, were controlling the medium completely.
They controlled it all. They called the shots.
And they decided which shows that they were going to pay for.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
So today
it's their money.
Yeah, it was their money, and they ran the network, so there you are. So today we're used to a lot of different products being presented during a commercial break, but back in radio, it was usually one sponsor per program. And how the radio stars actually felt about their sponsor varies greatly across the spectrum, but they could never ignore how important they were to their livelihood. But, you know, sometimes the connection between what was sponsoring the program and what the program was a very awkward connection. Here's a fine example.
The greatest name in rubber, Goodyear, invites you to meet America's greatest Western star, Roy Rogers.
Sure, I can see that.
The link being that they're both the greatest. That's it.
I can see that.
Here's one that's even a little more awkward.
C-A-M-B-L-S.
That's right, folks. C for comedy. A for Abbott. M for Maxwell. E for Ennis. L for Lou Costello. Put them all together and they spell Camel. Experience
wow.
is the best teacher. Try a Camel. And draw up a chair for tonight's Camel Show, starring Bud Abbott and Lou Costello.
So they all had the same letters in their names, huh?
Yeah, that was an episode of Abbott and Costello that featured Marilyn Maxwell and Skinny Ennis and his orchestra, hence the C for comedy, the A for Abbott, the M for Maxwell, the E for Ennis, and the L for Lou Costello spelling Camel. And of course, that show was actually called The Camel Show, even though it was Abbott and Costello on that show. Interesting thing about sponsors running the show, though, is that the men in charge of these companies got to express their personal taste in what radio program that they liked by being the sponsor.
Sure.
And Orson Welles put it in a great way in an interview. He said, there were all kinds of sponsors. There were nutty ones, rightists, leftists, idiots, bright people. And as a result, you had a variety of shows because they were the expressions of different kinds of people.
Oh, all right.
So, of course, now networks decide what shows they'll be, and then the sponsors can decide to buy airtime or not. So it's a little bit opposite of that. But then again, Steve, let's ask the real question. If you and I want a sponsor for the radio show, how are we going to get it?
Do you have an example?
Here's an example. Have you ever heard these guys?
Hey, Granny, Zeman, I believe that's our ring.
Hi, Dog Islam, I believe you're right.
I'll see. Hello, Jot 'em Down Store. This is Lum and Abner.
Lum and Abner, yeah. Are you a big fan?
No.
I can't say I am either, to be honest.
But I have heard about him.
But at one time, Lum and Abner were Chester Locke and Norris Joff, two struggling comedy performers who were down in Arkansas. And a station manager who was a friend of theirs suggested that they should go to Chicago and they should try to find a sponsor to get their act made into a radio show so they can stop struggling so much. And Joff's father heard that they were going to Chicago and was like, hey, while you're there, he ran a wholesale grocery store. He says, while you're there, can you stop in to Quaker Oats and make a deal for me? I need that, you know, he was trying to source some product for his store. And they said, oh, sure, since we're going to be there, we'll stop by, which they did. But during this conversation, when they're negotiating for Joff's father, they somehow admit to the executives that they're in town trying to find a sponsor for a radio show and that they're comedians. And this big room full of gray-haired men who are sitting in gigantic chairs, they say, just said, well, why don't you audition for us?
And so they did?
So they had all the men get up. They had to struggle turning these giant, massive chairs around so that they were only hearing them, and they performed. And, of course, I don't have a recording of the audition, but I thought people would want to hear what Lum and Abner sounded like a little more.
You withdraw from the race now. You done announced yourself. Name's right there on the hand circular. Abner Peabody for chief of police.
Yeah, but I tell you, I can't run again Elizabeth for the office long.
Well, you've got just as much right to run for that office as she has.
I've got to withdraw.
Let her talk you out of it.
She ain't talked me out of it. She ain't said a word except when she first found out I was running again her. She was out there back of the barn this morning practicing with a pistol.
With a pistol?
Now, when she's mad enough to start learning to shoot a revolver, why, it's time for me to withdraw from the race.
Well, maybe she's just practicing so that if she's elected chief of police, she'll know how to handle a gun.
Yeah, but... Oh. Hey, doggies, I hadn't thought about that.
Why, sure.
Yeah, so that's just about what she's doing at first.
There's some quality old-time radio. Yeah, I know a lot of people love Lum and Abner.
That's a very... dissing. Very early old-time radio. So Quaker Oats went for it. Sold.
Signed them up.
Later on, that show was sponsored by a company called Horlick. And the main reason why they were sponsored was that the company president, William Horlick, just loved the show. You know, it was his sole idea to sponsor the show, to take over. And, of course, the two actors had no idea how much it was his sole idea until he died, literally after signing them to contract like a month later. And as soon as their contract was up, they were dropped by the company.
No, really?
It was all that president's idea.
Oh, that's funny.
So anyway, since the sponsors were in control, they could change the script. They could do a lot of different things. For instance, Lucky Strike Cigarettes used to insist that every time the word fortunate was going to be used, it had to be changed to lucky. Or the announcer, Art Gilmore, had trouble getting work for a few years because his last name was the same name as a popular brand of gasoline at the time. And so he would be in advertising a different product than what the sponsor was advertising.
Well, he should have changed his name.
I know. Well, luckily, I guess that gasoline went out of favor or something because he did end up getting work.
I don't know Gilmore Gas.
No, I've never heard of it.
Some folks must.
Sponsors could get a network agreement to sponsor a show, but sometimes there weren't any shows that were needing sponsors, and that led to new shows. For instance, Hyman Brown, who was the director at the time of a show called Grand Central Station for Listerine, ended up getting a new show because the president of Lambert Pharmaceuticals, who made Listerine, was playing golf with the president of Carter's Little Liver Pills, and who wanted a show. And so they came to Hyman Brown, and they offered to pay him really well and asked him to invent another show. And that's how we got one of my favorite shows of all time.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host to welcome you in through the squeaking door to another half hour of horror. Come in, won't you? Sit down.
Inner Sanctum Mysteries.
I like that show.
I know you don't like it.
That's all right. That's
okay. We can have our differences.
I think it's funny that art and commerce, in a nutshell.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hire this artist. They must have been making boatloads of money for them to be so interested in sponsoring these radio shows.
Well, not everybody was making boatloads of money. One final note before we end this segment is that the networks couldn't always find a sponsor for a particular time or for a particular program, but they still felt a responsibility to fill the schedule with shows that they were calling sustaining programs at the time. And they were produced by the network, and the people who wrote and directed for those got paid next to nothing because there was no sponsorship money. But that was where people who worked in radio felt real freedom because they didn't have the sponsors overlording what they were able to do, and the networks let them have a lot of room to explore and be creative. And that's how we got people like writer and actor Orson Welles getting to try creative new things and becoming a star. In fact, this show, was a sustaining program until after this episode.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
So that was a sustaining program until we all know what happened with War of the Worlds.
That's interesting.
War of the Worlds attracted more attention for the episode than any other show had ever gotten in the history of radio. So a formerly unsponsored sustaining program all of a sudden became the Campbell Playhouse, taken over by Campbell Soup, replacing Mercury Theater on the air. Orson's producing partner at the time said this of the deal. He said, quote, "I guess they figured that if Orson could make War of the Worlds and a Martians credible, then he could make Campbell's Chicken Soup credible as well." So there you are.
And the effects sponsors have continue. And, you know, after all, it's art and commerce. Wouldn't be happening without the sponsors. All right. We'll talk again.
All right. Bye.
Andy Hurst reminded me of one of my regrets for this year, which was that we were reminded of the cinnamon bear. I know many of you love it.
With a human eyes, and I'm looking for someone to take by surprise. I go prowling and growling each night after dark, but the folks say my growl's just a cinnamon bark.
Just a cinnamon bark. Oh, I hope you don't regret having learned about the cinnamon bear. All right, then. You know, one of my other regrets is that I have not gone to as many places, nearly as many places, as Sarah Dickerman has recommended, as she has for much of this year, recommended lunch places. She is a writer for Slate, the New York Times. She blogs at sarahdickerman.com. There are so many places that you've mentioned that I have yet to go to, Sarah. And now here's another one I've never even heard of.
I know, and I regret that I haven't gone back to more after, you know, like you keep on moving forward and you always want to go back to your own favorites again and again.
So the Fish Cake Factory, do they make fish cakes? Is it a fish cake factory?
They do, and I love the name because I think there's nothing less likely to be made in a factory than a fish cake. So, it's a new Thai place run by a former chef at the well-known Thai restaurant called Bai Tong down in Tukwila that was near the airport. It specializes in fish cakes. And a Thai fish cake is a little bit of a slightly chewy, slightly bouncy affair called, often called Tod Moon. They say it's made with ladyfish paste. Ladyfish is a fish I haven't worked with myself a lot, but it's well spiced and yummy and a little, you know, satisfying in a chewy way. But then they also make these other fish cakes, which are maybe closer to like a crab cake that you've had at any number of Seattle restaurants, and so they make them with trout, with salmon, and really delicious one made with pork and shrimp together, and they're very delicate with a crispy kind of panko-style crumb coating, and they're super yummy, but the secret there also is I think the curries are quite excellent. So despite the name of the of this Thai restaurant, you can also go there and get a really well-made curry. I had a delicious green curry with tofu in it, and it was just, you know, not oversweet at all. A lot of American Thai places put a little too much sugar in their curries, and this one was not sweet, just beautiful and herbal and quite spicy. Their stars are accurate stars. So.
Oh, yeah? Oh, good. That's good.
Four was plenty spicy for me.
the Fish Cake Factory. I see they also have an Indian yellow curry salmon cake.
Yeah.
So you combine the two there with that.
Yeah, well, you know, there's all sorts of Indian flavors that, or Thai, you know, in Southeast Asia, you had Indian traders and stuff, so that's where some of those yellow curries already come from. There's definitely a tradition of cross-pollination of flavors. So it's a really nice place and a quiet stretch of Belltown, sort of off the main party drag of Belltown.
2510 4th Avenue.
Yeah.
Fish Cake Factory.
Uh-huh.
All right, great. All right, Sarah, my resolution is to hit my time post accurately. I know that's a little too much sausage making for some people, but I will do that. So we shall talk again in the new year.
Okay, well, the very best for the new year.
And to you. Sarah Dickerman writes for Slate, the New York Times, other publications. On Thursdays, she joins us with a lunch recommendation. There have been a whole slew of them this year, many that I have not attended. I hope you have. You can email us with some of your best fish and restaurant experiences. Tomorrow, the song that sings the year. Share that music with us. Thanks for listening. It's Weekday.
Good morning, it's 10:59. Headlines from NPR News are coming up next. Stay tuned.
This is Carl Castle from NPR News. If you make your tax-deductible donations at the close of the year, please consider giving to KUOW. The news coverage and information you rely on every day is possible thanks to the support of listeners who have become members. So please mail your gift today or make it online at KUOW.org. And thank you.
This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services, a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington. I'm Andy Hurst.
Next time in Studio 360, we look back a century to 1913.
It was the beginning of a century of absolute chaos.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.